My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Glenn David Gold. Glenn, welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Pleasure to be here.
Not necessarily in that order. Glenn David Gold was born in 1964, correct?
True.
You've written novels, short stories, comic books, and at least one episode for a TV cartoon.
That's true. I like you keep checking with me. Good. Yes.
Yes. I don't want to say anything bad. Right. His first novel, Carter Beats the Devil, was that your first novel?
First published novel, yes.
Okay, yeah. And, oh, that's right. You have a bunch that were stillborn.
Well, they were actually born. It's just that they were born horribly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Monsters.
Monsters,
I have a few of those myself.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that Carter Beats the Devil was your first book, and that was one of my favorite books of that year, 2001.
Oh, thank you.
Wonderful book. You also managed to fold your MFA thesis into that book, which I think is an admirable use of available resources.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah,
yes. I don't believe in wasting time at a certain point.
I see that, yeah. I'm adjusting the mic in case it sounds funny.
Okay.
I think along with Jonathan Lethem and Michael Chabon, you guys are among my favorite authors. But the other thing is you're not afraid to use American pop culture, the deep roots of American pop culture, is both source material and inspiration. Fair statement?
I'd say that's true. Yeah. It also strikes me as kind of funny that people are afraid of using such a thing. I don't know why they would be.
That's a really good question. Well, maybe that's a good place to start, is with the function of a historical novel to begin with.
Sure.
Somebody once said, not me, that a novel is a lie that shows us the truth.
Sure.
And I think you, maybe more than most, that's important to, because I hardly think that you stick to the letter of the history with the characters that you use, even though the historical characters, but I think you're trying to show us something about them by inventing situations for them.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. Secret here, I hate historical novels. And generally what I think about those is novels where there's some important person leaning back in their chair, musing about their accomplishments and thinking about their itchy tweeds. Like just using history as a form of respect, as if you're trying to illustrate a textbook or do an archaeological dig. I've always tried to treat history as something like character, scene, you know, its place, its setting, its emotion. It's another axis to be manipulated in order to get fiction to work. You know, we haven't actually been to the places that Raymond Carver specifically, we don't know his friends that he wrote about, but you can feel by the way he wrote about them, that they feel real. That's how I want to be in history. We weren't alive in 1918, most of us, but I hope that the way I write about it, it makes it feel like it could happen that way.
You know, I neglected to do it. I neglected to tell him the title of your latest book, which
is
Sunnyside, and it's Glenn David Gold. Good name for a marquee, Glenn David Gold, published by Alfred A. Knopf.
Also a good marquee name.
Also a good marquee name.
Yeah.
And came up for quite a few mentions over history. Everybody from the Marx Brothers to H.L. Mencken had something nasty to say about Alfred Knopf. So the old man is gone now.
Yes, even the Borzois that are used on there, I think, were kind of critiqued. Yeah,
that even his dogs didn't like him.
Yeah.
we have among the historical characters in this book is Charlie Chaplin.
Yes.
And Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford. And in this celebrity-crazed culture we live in now, I don't think that people understand that even back then in 1916, 1917, when the movies didn't even talk, mm-hmm. that movie actors were worshipped, admired, stalked. Everything that's going on now is going on then.
That's true. Well, they replaced royalty.
Especially in this country.
Yeah. Well, actually worldwide, if you think about it. To jump ahead, one of the things that happened between 1914 and 1918 is that as Europe was destroyed, so was its film industry. But there was still a hunger for the entertainment that people had seen. So Hollywood movies were exported overseas. And so as a kind of unplanned byproduct of it all, American actors became famous overseas in a way that didn't happen in reverse. The impetus of this book was that I had, when I was researching Carter, seen a picture of Houdini and Chaplin hugging. And I realized that Houdini was the first most famous man in the world in the modern sense, meaning he wasn't famous for being a king or a pope or for having actually done anything. He was famous for having manipulated media and gotten his shtick out there and his act. And I noticed that Chaplin was his successor, and I knew that there was a difference in their fame, but I couldn't quite quantify it. So hence 240,000 words trying to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you gave vent to a small book.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually one of the things I like about your book is that they're immensely readable. I have a current pain in my posterior about literary novels, which just annoy the hell out of me, because I find them pretentious, self-referential, drunk with their own words, and kind of dull. And the thing is that although you have beautiful passages of writing in here, this is a popular novel in the best sense of the word.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, I hope that at no point do you ever feel like I'm just sort of wandering into my own navel looking at something because I think it's interesting. My hope is to move forward the plot, the character, the theme, to engage the reader. I think it's kind of my job to keep the reader turning the pages for one reason or another rather than to make them know how brilliant I am, you know.
But you do along the way get us to realize how brilliant you are as well, so don't worry.
Okay, as long as that happens, but not first and foremost.
You're covering all the bases. Yeah. When I read Carter Beats the Devil, you're taking a relatively unknown magician. He was not unknown in his time, but in our time, a relatively unknown magician, Charles Carter, and you're creating an entire story around him, which includes people all the way up to President Harding.
Yes.
That's probably the most interesting thing he ever did, I'll tell you that, was be in your book. I'm not going to ask you how you get your ideas. That's a banal question. But what piqued your interest? Well, of all the things that go through your mind, what do you know as a book?
I don't even have an answer to that exactly, but I think that what I do know is that it's an accumulation of things that start to pile up on one on top of each other. In this particular case, well, in the Carter case, it was seeing a picture of a magic poster and realizing that there was a story within the magic poster. And this, it was the picture of Houdini and Chaplin hugging. I knew there was a story there somehow. And what I thought at first was that I was going to get near Charlie Chaplin, but not really inside his head. I thought, how could I possibly do that? But as I started reading his biographies, I felt like there was a, I can't think of a better word than lacuna in his the descriptions of him. They would go, you know, moment by moment, describe what happened to him, and then when it came to his psychology, basically throw their hands up in the air. And I couldn't figure out why they were doing that when it was quite obvious to me what was happening is he was the first person to become famous in a way that was out of control. And I grew up in Hollywood, so I've had friends to whom fame has happened, and I've known a genius or two in my life. And I understand how gravity warps around them and physics warps around these people based on their sheer force of will and people wanting to please them. And I realized that probably not a lot of other people have really explored that in a way. And so I wanted to dramatize both the person and then the idea of the person. So Chaplin is kind of the nucleus of the book. He's kind of the pebble dropping into the river. And then you see outside of it other people's opinions of him and how the changing world affected him and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. That's nice how you weave that together. One thing I should have mentioned this right at the beginning. There's a day in history where Charlie Chaplin was supposed to have appeared personally in about 150 different places and, of course, showed up nowhere as far as anybody knows.
Yeah, 800 places.
Yeah. 800 places? Yeah. Is that literally true?
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Yeah, I was. That was one of the little footnotes in David Robinson's very good biography of Charlie Chaplin, as he mentions among different types of Chaplinitis. Chaplin going from becoming basically a good comedian to becoming the world's most famous man almost overnight. He mentions in passing, I mean, almost as if it's a joke, but he mentions in passing this coverage in the news about November 12th, 1916, when Chaplin was either cited or anticipated in over 800 places at the same time. And then he kind of gives it sort of a joke explanation, or he just says, ha, 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 ha. And for myself, I think that there actually seems to have been some sort of mass hysteria based around the idea that we were just entering World War I. There had just been a presidential election that was incredibly tense. We didn't know who won the election for over a week. And there was like this mass need to cast a net out and try to find something that comforted us. And Chaplin seems to have been it somehow. I mean, that's as good an explanation as any. And that's the opening of the book, is we follow a kid named Leland who thinks that he's rescuing Chaplin at sea, a rather snobbish young man named Hugo who is involved in a train station riot, and then Chaplin himself on that day when we find out what he's actually doing. And then the rest of the book follows those three people through their next couple of years.
One of the things that's fascinating about that Chaplin occurrence is that it took the internet to create a similar thing now, this concept of going viral,
right,
where suddenly, you know, Susan Boyle is singing on some program in England, and next thing you know, there's 22 million hits on YouTube watching her sing. I mean, that's the only equivalent I can come up with. And we're talking about a time when the telegraph and the telephone were major technologies.
Right. Well, if you think about it also, though, that there was a concentration in that the only way the only type of entertainment in which something was mass-produced was film. If you wanted to go see somebody besides in a film, you had to go show up in the vaudeville hall and see them in person. There seems to be an added power to having witnessed somebody up on the screen that was psychologically not quite understood at that point. That's why one of the characters in my book is a film theorist who's trying to explain it all for us. When now it seems quite obvious that, you know, we understand a little bit about why we get so attracted to these large images on the screen and why it is that their emotions get reflected in us. In 1916, it was all a giant mystery and nobody had really gotten to the heart of it yet. So that's one of the reasons I think it was actually so potent is there was no internet. You know, there was no real radio. There was nothing else to compete with that sort of feeling.
Yeah, there are silent films of people watching silent films.
Yes.
And you can see a theater full of people hit the floor when a train comes toward the camera.
That's right. When in The Great Train Robbery, someone pulls a gun and points it toward the screen, everybody falls down. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Conceptions of reality they never really change much, do they? We as altered as our reality is, we don't have much more sophisticated conception of reality than that.
Well, we really don't. When things like, as I was writing this book, I noticed early on there was the Lonely Girl 15 phenomenon,
right,
when everybody believed that. We're going to keep being suckers and keep falling for things. I mean, and I think that we, in our understanding of the internet, are roughly where we were with film in 1903.
Yeah, there's a difference between being completely naive and being gullible, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Naive is a form of innocence, and gullibility is a form of stupidity, and I hope there's nothing that connects them, really. So, Charlie Chaplin, I think there are very few individuals in the world who have had as much written about them as Charlie Chaplin,
mm-hmm,
one way or another,
right,
even when it was the fan crap in Photoplay magazine and stuff like that.
Excuse me, let me dial down that word crap there for a minute.
Okay,
I mean,
okay.
Photoplay was actually a fairly sophisticated magazine for its time.
I'm surprised to hear that.
That's God bless eBay. I mean, I went on there and got the bought bound volumes of Photoplay for 1917, 1918, 1919. And if you have the slightest ability to read between the lines, you know, when you find about the sudden engagement of Mr. Charlie Chaplin to the 17-year-old Mildred, who will not be appearing for the next 6 months according to doctor's orders on screen, you
right,
understand what's going on there. They were what was interesting to them is this was the first time any audience was there. Was this is the first time there's a magazine devoted to a profession, if you think about it. Beforehand, where were the magazines devoted to a single profession?
They didn't exist.
Which was Lancet? I'm sorry.
Lancet is the British medical magazine, which has been around since the 19th century.
But was that promoting the private lives of doctors and explaining what they were like?
No, it was promoting technique, I think.
But it wasn't talking about what they were like personally, or what a doctor's theory was on what kind of color a person should be, or something like
well
that.
Well played.
So these were the first times that we were like promoting these personalities, and the way the personalities were promoted was with a Mencken-like cynicism. You shouldn't believe what we're telling you, but here it is. And so it was simultaneously giving you the image of the person and then also the idea of, you know, in Hollywood, there is no real pain. We all drink champagne, you know, and that's kind of what was given to you at the same time as the films.
I will talk about other people than Charlie Chaplin eventually, but mm-hmm, I'm fascinated with Charlie Chaplin personally. So,
yeah.
My feeling about him is that he really was a neurotic narcissist, and that do we like him so much?
Yeah.
And I think that his public face and his private behavior were not always the kinds of things we wanted to think about. His public face is good, mm-hmm, and especially if you're a lefty, he was persecuted for his left-wing convictions.
Yeah.
But on a personal level, he was a kind of a bounder and a cad, wasn't he?
He was a bounder and a cad, but also he was somebody who was given infinite resources and no boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Late in the book, he's had one success after another. He's a totally independent producer, and it's the first time in history any artist doesn't really have a patron to please. He can do anything he wants. And given that, you know, I'm not sure that I would have the wherewithal to kind of draw myself in and be a decent human being all the time. And the other thing about that is that, you know, with genius is a little patience. You know, what's the balance, you know, if he's going to be a good person or is he going to devote himself to his art? And he actually has to make a choice a few times in the book about that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you read the biographies, there does seem to be a point where he went from being a curious, interested, wanting to be involved person to being a bit of a jerk. And I think that part of the book chronicles that, with that apotheosis, as it were.
Well, let's remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Glenn David Gold. The title of his book is Sunnyside, one word, Sunnyside, published by Knopf. I know that, at least I'm pretty sure I know, that United Artists was founded by three people, Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, and Douglas Fairbanks, Sr. And that
D.W. Griffith.
And D.W. Griffith. And one of the reasons they did it was to escape the machinations of the studio system, even then,
yes,
in before 1920.
Yes.
And they had control of their own material. They didn't own the stuff that they did for the studios. It was good.
Correct.
It was a good thing. Mary Pickford was a remarkable person in mm-hmm. many ways, and was probably the most loved person in the United States for the movie-going public, certainly,
yes,
and one of the most loved people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And she was almost as good as that. At least that's my knowledge of her.
Yeah. Have you seen many Mary Pickford films? Most people haven't.
I have a couple. Yes.
Yeah. The ones that are actually out that seem mostly available are the ones that are the soupiest sort of. The ones that are really good are a little harder to find. But she had tremendous range. She did have that ability to, whatever was on her face, you believed. And you really did feel empathy for her in a way that was fantastic. And that was one of her many genius abilities.
She was also simultaneously impressed by and repelled by Charlie Chaplin. She admired his talent, but didn't think he was much of a person.
Yeah.
Is that a fair statement?
I'd say that's pretty true. I think it was probably mutual, too. I think Chaplin couldn't take her business sense. He also felt that what she did was sentimental claptrap, that what he did was actual art.
Of course, he hadn't done The Kid yet. But
not yet.
Yeah. Because he got really deep into that eventually.
He did.
I think a lot of people who like silent film and great film acting of the old school will tell you that the reason Buster Keaton is better than Charlie Chaplin is there's not an ounce of sentimentality in any of his films.
This is true. Well, I think that in my book I try to cover a little bit about why the sentimentality comes out the way it does and why the slapstick comes out the way it does with Chaplin. But a little bit about the founding of UA, if this helps at all. Part of the book is about the harnessing of Hollywood for military purposes. There was a guy named William Gibbs McAdoo, who was the founder of the Federal Reserve System, whose job in part was to pay for the war, World War I. And so he founded some Liberty Loan Drives. And then by the time, the first two didn't go that well. People weren't keeping up their wallets. But he noticed that people would pay money to go see movies. So he convinced Chaplin, Pickford, Fairbanks, and William S. Hart to go across the country and campaign. And it ended up being the largest crowds in American history came out, and they paid for the war that way. And at the end of all this, McAdoo was impressed enough to become general counsel and found United Artists with them. He quit the government to go into Hollywood. And I just found that also to be a fascinating sort of combination of events.
William S. Hart was the first great cowboy star.
He was.
Yeah. Yeah. Before Tom Mix, before any of those other guys, he set the mold, I think, for the cowboy star.
He did. He wrote a wonderful autobiography, My Life East and West, which all the proceeds went to the SPCA, as I recall.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Speaking of the SPCA, let's talk about Leland Wheeler.
Oh, yes.
Yes. We pretty much start the book with him, because he's the one that attempts to save Charlie Chaplin.
Yes.
He really thinks he's going to save Charlie Chaplin when he sees a sailboat foundering.
Mm-hmm.
He's on the Oregon coast, isn't he?
He's just south of the Oregon coast.
Oh,
yes.
That's
he's
right. Yeah.
St. George Reef Lighthouse.
That's right.
Lighthouse,
yeah.
Off of Crescent City.
Crescent City.
So
yeah.
I don't want to sell your Oregonian, listeners
that's
on
right.
Like, you know, you're 8 miles south of it. You know, it's outside of their bailiwick. Sorry. Yeah.
It's right. Funny. I'm reading a book now that takes place on the Oregon coast. So I'm,
yeah.
I digress. He's an interesting kid.
Mm-hmm.
He lives with his mother. His mother's a lighthouse keeper.
Yes.
And he is learning the lighthouse keeper profession.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their life. Their life pretty much revolves around keeping the light going back and forth to the lighthouse. She's very protective of him, and he doesn't quite understand why.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I want to give away why that is, but if you want to, feel free. Maybe you want to tell us about Percy Bysshe Duncan.
Well, I'll tell you just this much, which is that I was interested in the idea of that almost... I'm interested in the idea of the immaculate hero and the kind of the crazy conceptions of heroes, and I wanted to give Leland a father who would be part of a dying art form. And he ends up being the head of the last a Wild West troupe that goes through and performs in Berlin the day that World War I starts. They're performing for the Kaiser right as the war is starting. And that's based in part on truth. There really were Onondaga Indians performing for the Kaiser as World War I was developing.
And they get around in your book, too.
They show up from here and there, yeah. Yes. You never, you know, no one's ever totally counted out. They keep popping up again. You know, I don't really drop a ton of plot threads, but... So Leland, he has that father as somebody in this antique art form that's got to do with recreating war that never really comes back again after World War I, in part because World War I is the first war that people could actually see in film. And so there was no real need for people to go in and make it happen again in an arena or anything like that.
I suppose it's true after any major war, but I think more so in Europe than anywhere else, the effects of World War I were devastating. An entire generation of young men mm-hmm. was better than decimated. More than one out of ten was killed. Mm-hmm. And it changed the way everybody thought about everything. Cynicism and Dada became popular after the war because nothing made any sense anymore, so what the hell?
Right.
And some of that is created in your book by the Russian campaign, which nobody knows about anymore.
The Russians
remember it pretty well. But we actually sent American troops to Russia to put down the Bolsheviks.
We did.
And what a dumb idea. Tell us about our troops in Russia.
Well, toward the end of 1918, President Wilson, who it should be remembered was a Democrat and an intellectual, felt that by sending 5,900 troops from Detroit to fight the 2-million-strong Red Army, that they would win because the populace would be on our side, that the mere fact of Western boots upon the ground would cause democracy to flower in their wake. And he genuinely
believed
it.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Really? I don't know what you're talking about.
Neither do I.
But I obviously there are some parallels with what happened in more recent times. But I wanted to not just draw such a straight line there, because if you write historical fiction with your finger pointing at something specifically, Carter would have been like, you know, a scathing indictment of the second Clinton administration or something like that. It dies very quickly. To me, there are motifs in our country's history that keep repeating. I mean, history repeats itself. It does it all the time. And to me, this is just something that's happened over and over again. We just happen to be in that phase again right now. The Americans were in Archangel Russia for about a year, and they at one point penetrated 400 miles into the place. They thought they were going to convert the populace. It never really happened. They didn't know why they were there. And they were, in my mind at least, it was kind of a collision between two worldviews, both of them thinking, and with total justice, they were absolutely right. The Russian worldview, which is the world is an essentially cruel place and your choices are between dying and dying. And the American worldview, which is, hey, we've got the world's largest stove in Detroit and, you know, we've got movie stars and things are kind of good. And neither side could see the other one's point of view.
No wonder they think we're a bunch of adolescents in Europe. I mean, because in many ways it's true.
In many ways it's true.
And that's the best thing about us.
Well, that is true. It's also because there is infinite, in a way, there is the promise of infinite promise here. But at the same time, it's like, as I say in the book, it's a perpetual motion machine, constantly extending with one hand and taking it back with the other.
I want to talk about Hugo Black, who I presume is not the Supreme Court Justice, Hugo Black.
No, the name just appealed to me.
Okay, what's a good name? He gets caught in a riot early in the book, one of the chaplain riots at the train station. But he winds up in Russia.
In Archangel Russia, yeah.
And trying to survive as best he can in mm-hmm. an incredibly hostile environment.
Yes.
And not only are the people more or less hostile, depending on what day it is or what they need from you, mm-hmm. but the climate is unbearably hostile in the wintertime. And they get there in the fall when they don't really see it yet.
Right.
Yeah. Is he... What were you trying to give us with Hugo Black? What were you wanting us to see?
What I wanted you to see was a ground level possibility of absurdity of war. The important thing for me was not just Hugo, but his boss, General Ironside
yeah.
put together.
Great name.
Well, very real. Mm-hmm. And Hugo to me was it was a stand-in for myself or for anybody else who has always felt like a little bit of an outsider, put into a place that they can't quite understand, wanting to do good. and feeling like constantly just on the verge of maybe making a breakthrough and knowing somebody or liking somebody or, you know, making friends with the populace for a second, and then it just never goes well because just of your own prejudices or theirs, and wanting to get out of a bad situation. And on the other side, you have the person who's running the show, General Ironside, who's got all the information, all the humanity, all the smarts. He's the type of guy who, as I describe him repeatedly, I think is the type of person you would feel would lead you and would do a good job of it. And he makes the wrong decision every single time. And to me, that's the kind of the Graham Greene tragedy of the whole thing is that, you know, if you look at Iraq, we see like a bunch of terrible decisions made by people who were kind of forced into them or were ideologically bound. Ironside makes terrible decisions based on the actual information that's in the room. And so it's not that simple all the time. And I just wanted to give a bit of, you know, I have, you know, toward the end of the book, I thank the last surviving American doughboy out there because I really do feel a great deal of sympathy for the people who are out there fighting America's wars for greater purpose or less because they really are giving their lives for it. And so I wanted to give you a character who is literally going through hell and ends up going through fairy tales on his way to hell. I mean, things are just so awful that you end up with him with a crossbow trying to defend some dancing princesses.
A crossbow, the Russian princesses.
Yeah.
That was great.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. We only have a couple minutes left, and I really just want to mention one thing and have you, you know, give us a couple minutes on it. Charles Carter, forgetting Charles Carter, I think if you talked to anybody in this country under 40 years old and said Rin Tin Tin, they would think you had lost your mind.
Really? But,
yeah. Who remembers Rin Tin Tin?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I'm 45, so I'm the wrong key audience.
Yeah,
I think people under 45 know that there was a dog named Rin Tin Tin, but maybe not. Why.
Yeah, well, you know,
like
maybe,
Lassie or something like that.
Well, Lassie, that's because every collie in America is named Lassie at some point. But you don't, you know. I mean, shepherds are named Rex now, or some King, or something like that. Not Rin Tin Tin.
I think perhaps I come at it. I'm a shepherd owner, so I think perhaps this other shepherd owners and I all seem to know the name a little bit there. But what happened is I got interested in I found out that the most popular film star of the 1920s, the most as far as box office, was Rin Tin Tin. He was the top earner.
Top dog.
Okay, yes. Yeah, he saved a Warner Brothers from bankruptcy. And I thought, wait a minute, wasn't Chaplin the top? Wasn't Pickford the top? No, it was Rin Tin Tin. And I found that to be very confusing and interesting. And then Jeanine Basinger wrote this wonderful book on silent stars that has a chapter on Rin Tin Tin explaining his appeal. And I thought that he made a wonderful hero, but I didn't know how he fit into the book. And then I found out about his own conception, found on the battlefields of France by an American soldier. And all the book colors within the lines pretty closely everything that happens on the battlefield, relatively speaking, about his finding, because it's so interesting and so odd. And to me, also perpetuates the idea of what is a hero and what is a movie star and when do they intersect?
Well, he didn't have a riotous personal life like the other movie stars did, and you could send your kids to see him.
Yes, exactly.
With impunity. Did he really have a smarter sister?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to read the book for that. I'm like, we don't have any time for one thing, but I wouldn't give that away anyway. It's been fun speaking with you. Glenn David Gold is the author of Sunnyside, published by Alfred A. Knopf. What are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on memoir.
A memoir?
Yes.
Interesting. So when are we going to see that?
Well, since it seems to take me about 8 years to write every book, sometime before like 2017 probably. Yeah.
Oh, well, at least you know the source material for this one.
I do, yeah.
Thanks a lot for coming.
Pleasure to be here, Ed. Thank you.